And now I'm coming to the part that's just incredible for a small-town judge from rural Indiana. It is my distinct honor to introduce to you the Chief Justice of the Supreme Court of British Columbia. Justice Brenner was appointed a judge of the Supreme Court of British Columbia in 1992 and Chief Justice of the Court in 2000. He is a graduate of the University of British Columbia Law School. He was called to the British Columbia Bar in 1971. He started his own law firm in Vancouver called Brenner & Company, which specialized in the fields of aviation, professional indemnity, and products liability law. Since joining the Supreme Court of BC in 1992, Chief Justice Brenner has been active on a number of court committees dealing with technology, court administration, and reforms of the justice system. In 2002, Chief Justice Brenner was a founding member of the Justice Review Task Force, which was set up to examine improvements in the justice system in BC. He co-chaired the Civil Justice Reform Working Group, which released a report at the end of November of last year, containing recommendations for significant changes to the existing civil justice system in British Columbia. To implement those recommendations, he has participated in a complete revision of the BC rules, civil rules of court, which are expected to be adopted later in 2008. Ladies and gentlemen, it is my very high honor to introduce to you Chief Justice Donald Brenner.
Well, thank you, Bill. Thank you very much for those very kind remarks. Let me start off by saying welcome. Welcome to Vancouver. Welcome to British Columbia. We are indeed delighted that you are here, and that it is a great pleasure to be able to join you this evening and say a few words of welcome. I'm particularly pleased to do this because of the fine work that your organization does in bringing together interdisciplinary and international professionals, all of whom are dedicated to the resolution of family conflict. And also because of your conference theme this year, Fitting the Forum to the Family. I think that is one that resonates very strongly for me, and I'm sure it also resonates for a wide range of professionals serving in the justice system today. As you well know, the scale of family breakup is large. In our province, about 40% of all marriages end in separation. In our court, the Superior Trial Court, about 12 to 13,000 family cases are filed each year. And in the provincial court, which has concurrent jurisdiction with us in most family areas, about a similar number of cases are filed. Now, I think it's fair to say that over the last 30 years, reports have come to similar conclusions about how these cases should be managed. They tell us a number of things, I think. Family disputes are almost best resolved outside of a courtroom. The court, of course, is a valued but a last resort for family conflict. And, of course, there are a number of problems with the court process, as you well know. Cost, delay, and complexity create problems of accessibility. We see that every day with the increasing number of self-represented litigants that come to our court without counsel. The adversarial process, of course, is not designed to address those intense emotional issues that often arise from family breakup. Families in conflict, I believe, need at an early stage information, advice, and support so they can take as much responsibility as possible for creating their own solutions. I believe the system must support alternative approaches such as mediation and judicial dispute resolution that address the underlying emotional and personal issues that so often drive family conflict. Now, here in British Columbia, our court in 2002 brought about some fundamental changes to the family area with the adoption of mandatory judicial case conferences in family cases. These events must occur before either party can file a contested application. Our judges and the bar have found these to be highly effective in settling cases entirely, or at least narrowing the issues for trial. Madam Justice Donna Martinson, my colleague, Thank you. My colleague on our court was the chair of our family law committee, our court's family law committee at the time, and she was one of the principal architects of this very successful initiative. In 2005, the NBC, the Family Justice Reform Working Group, published a report entitled A New Justice System for Children and Families. That working group was made up of representatives of the Supreme and Provincial Courts, the Family Bar in rural and urban areas, the mediation community, and the Ministry of the Attorney General. Widespread support for the report across the justice system and its companion paper on the civil justice reform has resulted in a three-year justice transformation initiative in BC with a focus on the civil and family side on establishing a single front door to the justice system. We've settled on a name for these. We are calling them Justice Access Centers, with core services such as public information and education in a resource room, needs assessment, and referral, mediation, and limited legal advice. And so far, I'm pleased to report that the ones that have been established are doing very, very well. They've been very well received, and the lawyers, the bar in particular, are very strong fans. As well, we're simplifying court rules and processes and testing new ways to move cases more efficiently through the courts. This review has opened the door to dialogue with professionals and the public, including children impacted by divorce and separation, about critical matters such as how should the law reflect society's concern about violence in family disputes? How can we hear the voices of the children in decisions that affect them? How can we assist parents to meet their access responsibilities? Can we simplify procedural matters, such as the division of property? Over the next 3 days, you will be sharing your experience and expertise in fitting the forum to the family. Much will be learned from other jurisdictions that approach similar problems in innovative ways. I'm grateful to be a part of this work and would like to recognize the contributions of just a few of my colleagues who will be here in Vancouver participating in the conference, including Mr. Justice Emil Krizik of the Ontario Superior Court of Justice, Mr. Justice George Sutran, is he here? The Honorable Stephen Thackeray, Chief Judge, Family Court of Western Australia, I believe is here as well. Yesterday I had the pleasure of meeting the Chief Justice of the Family Court of Australia, the Honorable Diana Bryant. Chief Justice, are you here? Ah, nice to see you again. And the Honorable Peter Boshier, the Principal Family Court Judge from New Zealand. So finally, let me close by wishing you well with your conference. I do hope that you will enjoy your stay in our city, and I can't leave without reminding you that in February 2010, we'll be welcoming the world to the Winter Olympics. So we hope you will all come back and enjoy the winter sports on that occasion. Thank you very much.
Okay. Thank you, Chief. It is my pleasure at this time to introduce the moderator for this panel, my friend and colleague, the Honorable Emil Krizik. Emil is a judge of the Superior Court of Justice in Ontario, Canada. He works primarily in Brampton and Orangeville, Ontario, and formerly in his past life was a family law attorney. Emil? Oh, and AFCC Vice President.
Thank you, bro. Now, is this mic on? Ça marche maintenant? Oui? Bonne soirée et bienvenue à tous et à toutes. Ça me fait plaisir de vous accueillir à Vancouver. That was simply to wake you up and to alert you to the fact that Canada is bilingual, but we will be conducting our sessions in English. So in English, good evening and welcome everyone. As a Canadian member of AFCC and its executive, it gives me great pleasure to welcome you to Canada and to beautiful British Columbia. You know, with the mountains and the flowers, I sometimes wonder why I live in Ontario. But Canada is diverse, and welcome to Vancouver. Or as we would say, welcome to Vancouver, eh? Tonight's program is merely a savory appetizer for the delectable conference menu that we have for you. It is a veritable smorgasbord of choices that you have. And I know that you will have difficulty in making the selection as to which session you will attend. It will be difficult for you for the next few days. I'll try to make as many as I can. Tonight's program emanates from the AFCC and the National Council of Juvenile and Family Court Judges' participation in the Wingspread Conference, which was held in February 2007. To my mind, it was a turning point for the way we looked at domestic violence and is a true milestone for this organization and the NCJFCJ. The Wingspread Conference featured 37 participants from different backgrounds that included family court judges, lawyers, domestic violence advocates, social science and legal scholars, court administrators, and psychologists. And until this conference, there had been no large canvas of the disparate views that our professions deal with and attempt to resolve how we could improve the system for families who are afflicted by domestic violence. As you know, domestic violence knows no borders. It is a serious and widespread problem that we all have to deal with in our world. Tonight's presenters took part in the Wingspread Conference. They are truly the best in their field. And it is no wonder that AFCC is successful as it is when we can claim these three incredible women as part of our membership. I am so proud of each and every one of you. In tonight's program, we will begin with Professor Nancy Versteeg and Professor Claire Dalton, who will provide us with an overview on the Wingspread Conference and their report. And then we will have Joan Kelly review some of the research in the field of domestic violence. Her time is unfortunately limited, but I know that Joan will attempt to give us at least a nutshell version of the research. So let me begin by introducing Professor Versteeg and Professor Dalton. Nancy Versteeg. She is a professor at William Mitchell College of Law in St. Paul, Minnesota. There she teaches family law, domestic violence law, and policy, and alternate dispute resolution. Nancy has published extensively. Her publications include articles about child custody and domestic violence, mediation and domestic violence, children and domestic violence, and mandatory divorce education. She is also the co-author of two family law books, the first, The Work of the Family Law Lawyer, and the second, Family Law, Examples and Explanations. She is a frequent presenter at conferences and is a member of the board of directors of the Family Law Quarterly. She is also a member of the board of directors of the Family Court Review. I've come to know Nancy as a member of the board of directors of the AFCC, and it's been my great pleasure to work with Nancy. She has prior experience working as a legal aid lawyer representing victims of domestic violence, and she has trained not only judges, but police, prosecutors, and obviously her law students. Professor Versteeg earned her JD from Washington University School of Law, and she also has a MSW from the George Warren Brown School of Social Work. Claire Dalton is a distinguished university professor of Northeastern University in Boston, Massachusetts, School of Law. There she teaches torts, family law, and the law of domestic violence. She is the founder and former executive director of Northeastern's Domestic Violence Institute, for which she has very attractively received funds from multiple sources. Her recent articles address the role of the family court system in cases involving domestic violence. She, too, has co-authored and one of her publications is Domestic Violence and the Law, Theory and Practice. She has also co-authored Navigating Custody and Visitation Evaluations in Cases with Domestic Violence, a judge's guide. God knows I could use that sometime. That has been published by the National Council for Juvenile and Family Court Judges. It is recently revised in 2006, originally published in 2004. Professor Dalton is a frequent presenter at national conferences and in training programs for legal and other professionals, working with individuals, families who are exposed to domestic violence within the home. Claire Dalton earned her Bachelor in Jurisprudence from Oxford University in the United Kingdom and a Master of Law degree from Harvard Law School. So without further ado, let me turn you to Nancy and Claire, who co-authored the Wingspread Report, and that will be the subject of their presentation tonight.
Thank you for a very, am I speaking loud enough? Yes. Thank you for a very generous introduction. Thank you all for being here. I'm going to get straight to the point. Here in 2008, domestic violence is commonly, if not universally, recognized as a serious and widespread problem, with potentially far-reaching consequences, not only for its adult victims and their abusers, but also for their children. But how domestic violence is defined, why it happens, exactly how common or dangerous it is, and how the family court system should respond to it, around these issues there has been surprisingly little agreement. Those working in the field as practitioners have viewed domestic violence from different and sometimes competing perspectives. Researchers have used very different definitions and methodologies, and unsurprisingly generated a variety of sometimes contradictory findings. The exchanges between camps, as probably many of you in this room have experienced, have sometimes been flat out acrimonious. Given this history, the convening of the Wingspread Conference on Domestic Violence and Family Courts to open a productive dialogue about these differences was a remarkable accomplishment. It took courageous leadership from the AFCC and the NCJFCJ, and in particular the vision and commitment of Peter Salem and Billy Lee Dunford Jackson to bring it about. Beyond that, it took faith on the part of each participant that the group would be able to work in good faith across sometimes long-standing suspicion and disagreement, towards finding common ground and lay a foundation for better policy, practices, and services in support of families affected by domestic violence. When was the last time a law review article moved you to tears? Not a common experience, but I had it when I read the piece that Peter Salem and Billy Lee Dunford Jackson have co-authored in this most recent issue of the Family Court Review. I'm not going to be the last person recommending to you that you read it, but I do recommend that you read it very highly. In any event, Peter and Billy Lee got us to Wingspread, and Nancy and I were fortunate enough to share in that process as reporters, and so we're here today in that capacity to share with you what emerged from the conference. That's to prove that we were really there and we worked very hard. So despite the differences, everybody who works with families in the family court wants two things for them. We want safety, and we want families to be able to emerge from the process with as good a quality of life and with as good an environment for their children as is possible. Given that common ground, the concerns arise around what is necessary for safety and what are the best outcomes to promote the welfare of children. And so we started from the proposition that if we could differentiate on the basis of context, on the basis of what we know about patterns of violence in families, on the basis of what we know about which the variables are that lead us to fear risk or to be optimistic about positive outcomes, if we could find agreement on some of those scores, then perhaps the area of our common ground could grow. So take something as simple as a slap. Everyone who came to Wingspread found a level of agreement in saying not all slaps mean the same thing. In one instance, it might be a single act of violence where there's no prior history, and it may have been triggered by a provocative statement. In another instance, it might be the first act of physical violence, but in a relationship in which there's been a long history of controlling behaviors and other kinds of abuse, emotional abuse, isolation, financial control. In yet a third situation, it might be a slap with an extensive past history of physical violence. It may be that this slap came only 2 weeks after the same person's nose was broken by their partner, or they were sent to the hospital with a concussion. So in attending to the context, we have to be aware of two possible dangers. Are we, because we're persuaded that there are positive aspects to the parents' relationships with the children, are we ignoring danger signals, and is safety being compromised? And on the other hand, if we impose a one-size-fits-all solution with respect to any acts of physical violence, are family relationships perhaps unnecessarily compromised? So we asked ourselves at Wingspread, when we look at the context, what are we looking for? What is the level of ongoing risk to the family members, with or without interventions that the court may be able to make? And what is the likely efficacy or impact of particular interventions or custody and access determinations? And we asked ourselves in particular, can we identify where there is potential for lethality? When can we be clear that the past gives us reason to fear future violence? And when can we investigate to learn what other forms of intimidation may be lying behind the particular violent incident that is our focus at this given moment? And all of that, of course, in addition to the usual inquiries that we always want to make into children's needs, interests, and well-being, any history of child maltreatment, and what the family strengths or protective factors may be. Now, Joan is going to be spending a good deal more time talking with you about differentiation of different kinds of violence from the perspective of what the research has to tell us. So my goal here is the simpler one of just sharing with you the common ground that we were able to reach at Wingspread. So one of the pieces of work that we looked at is by Desmond Ellis and Noreen Stuckless, looking at a screening instrument that they are proposing for domestic violence cases. And their suggestion is that these risk indicators are statistically significant predictors of male violence, past abuse of other kinds, emotional dependency of the perpetrator on the victim, a history of relationship problems, issues of control, and then mental health problems and substance abuse. Janet Johnston also presented to us another set of risk indicators growing out of the research. And I don't want to reiterate the ones that were on the previous list, but if you look at this, you'll see some interesting additions. The first, number one and number three, threats and fantasies of serious harm and the availability of weapons. In other words, not just the history of past violence, but what is there to lead us to believe that there is considerable potential for violence in the future. High depression and rage, item number five here, along with obsession with or possessive attitude towards the partner. This, in a sense, is fleshing out those aspects of emotional dependency and control. And then the two final items here, a disregard or contempt for authority, which may mean that an abuser is not going to pay much attention to a restraining order or to other prescriptions that the violence ought to stop. And then existence of a recent stressor, which may, again, reduce someone's capability to control their ongoing behavior. We also looked at Wingspread at whether we could discern from these factors and from the experience of violence in families, both how those have been looked at in the research and also people's clinical experience and experience in the courts. Could we resolve some of these variables into patterns of violence that might give us a better guideline as to which intervention could fit which family? Violence in the exercise of coercive control is the first category, and this is what is often called classic abuse or classic battering. In other words, there is physical violence, but it's part of a broader pattern of abuse and control. This pattern of violence, the research is telling us, is not exclusively, but much more commonly, male-on-female violence. In other words, men are the abusers when it's this kind of violence we're talking about, and women are much more commonly the victims. Violent resistance or self-defense is much more commonly used by women against the male partner who is abusing them. Violence driven by conflict, but in the absence of coercive control, in other words, in the absence of this pattern of controlling behavior, the community studies show us is a much more even proposition, perpetrated by men and by women, and often perpetrated by both partners in the same relationship. The only gender disparity here is that women are more often seriously injured by this violence than men. Separation-instigated violence is the kind of violence that erupts in a relationship only after one of the partners is seeking to end the relationship. It's violence, again, it only gets put in this category if it is in the absence of a pattern of coercive control, only if it's new violence at separation. And if it is, then again, it can be perpetrated by men or by women. It's a more gender-neutral style of violence. And finally, violence stemming from severe mental illness, which again can be on the part of a woman or a man. There's been, again, a substantial amount of dispute and disagreement about these categories in the past. And what happened at Wingspread was that we were able, by becoming sort of more sophisticated in our definitions of the different types, to then understand the research better that has had these discrepant findings, especially about the gendered patterns of violence. So this slide was just to underscore, in a sense, that what I've just been saying, that if we're going to talk about these different categories, then we may be able to talk also more sensibly about who is using which kind of violence in relationship. On the other hand, even when we know that a pattern has a gendered quality to it, that does not mean that in every case it's going to match the pattern. So there will be women who use coercive control against their male partners. And there will be women who are doing more physical damage to their male partners in conflict-driven violence. we have to be both attentive to the pattern and also to realize that it doesn't explain every case and that attention to individual context is always also critical. At this point, I get to turn the podium over to Nancy to carry us forward.
Screening and triage. Everybody at Wingspread agreed that we should screen every case entering the family court system for domestic violence. Am I up? Okay. Strong agreement, I'll repeat, about the need to screen cases entering the family courts for the existence of domestic violence or a history of domestic violence. There was less agreement, however, on exactly who should do that and how it should be done. In particular, participants discussed three challenges, and there are more than three challenges related to this topic. One, how possibly can we create an instrument, if we're going to use an instrument, that would be sufficiently nuanced and complex to be effective in giving us good information about what has happened, and at the same time be so user-friendly that a variety of people can administer it? Because screeners, of course, may come from very different educational backgrounds and have different experience levels. How could there be an instrument that would be useful for all these purposes? And these are some somewhat unanswered questions. Second challenge, how to create screening protocols that are both culturally and socioeconomically appropriate. Third challenge, how to include feedback loops, because inevitably some mistakes are going to be made with respect to screening. How do we ensure some accountability in the process and make sure that, we have many ways to have input? We talked about a few promising approaches. Two of these include the following. One is using a multi-method, multi-informant approach. And this is explained in more depth in an article by Jaffe, Crooks, and Bela. But the idea is to have a continuous process using a variety of sources and methods that to uncover and continue to look for domestic violence in cases entering the courts. As indicators show, a likelihood of high conflict or of domestic violence or both, that then there would be further investigation, perhaps use of different sorts of tools and different kinds of screening as more is uncovered. A second promising approach, which was previously mentioned by Claire, is use of the Dove instrument developed by Ellis and Stuckless, which has been empirically validated, which of course many screening instruments that are useful but have not necessarily been validated or looked at for their significance. And here they have identified some statistically significant predictors of violence and developed an instrument that links those risks and indicators to specific interventions to enhance safety, at least as a part of the mediation process. Processes and services. With this idea, and imagine a mind experiment here, that we could differentiate families, detect domestic violence and the history of domestic violence, and start treating families more individually. It's certainly possible and becomes more possible to tailor interventions to meet the needs of those particular families, which is, of course, the subject of our conference this week. Some families who've experienced domestic violence may, in fact, be able to participate in existing programs and services. I was saying that in some situations, families who've experienced domestic violence may, in fact, be able to participate in existing services and processes. And we're talking here about things like parent education, mediation, supervised parenting time, substance abuse programs. Other families who've experienced domestic violence, though, participation in existing programs would really be unsafe for them. So the question arises, how do we modify some programs so that they're safe for families who've experienced domestic violence, but they can also take advantage of them? Outcomes for children. And you can see here we have almost a teeter-totter going on. How do we balance the need for safety with questions of access? And I know the judges in the audience have to deal with this on an almost daily basis. Everybody at Wingspread strongly agreed that we need to take special precautions in cases where there's been domestic violence or it's alleged, and have to use some different processes and procedures to do this balancing act. At Wingspread, we talked about several things which I think are going to be explored in more depth tomorrow at tomorrow's plenary session, so I'll only touch on them. One is this idea of phases of decision-making, that on a temporary basis, safety would be a strong priority. Little information may be available, but decisions need to be made quickly. As the case progresses and more information becomes known, longer-term parenting arrangements can be made. Here, however, we encounter issues to do with conflicting priorities. There are many. Looking at sort of a continuum of parenting arrangements. What are all the possibilities? How can we match some of those arrangements to the needs of families? What indicators would be useful? I think tomorrow there'll be some discussion about the three P's, and I'm going to mention here consensus about the three R's, which is that any kind of parenting arrangement may need to be continually refined. We need to make sure that these arrangements are realistic for families, and we need to make these arrangements in light of existing actual resources, which leads us to the next topic. Oh, there we go. A strong consensus that we desperately need more resources in the family court system, and I doubt that anyone here would disagree with that. We're seeing increasing caseloads. Cases are more and more complex, often involving pro se litigants. And it's not that many of our resources and budgets are being held static. It's that many of them are actually being decreased. Courts are asked to do more with less every day of the week. On top of this situation, we're asking more and more of our courts. The role of the court, the family court, has changed significantly and continues to change. As we've been talking about, courts are more frequently and judges are called on to be case managers, to participate in differential case management, to handle cases in a different way. This raises other challenges about how do we provide training for people who are being asked to do things that they didn't used to do? Are there any unforeseen consequences from some of these new roles? How do these new roles intersect with due process concerns, and how do they intersect with the traditional role of the court as fact finder and decision maker? And in a time of scarce resources, these are doubly complex questions. There was resounding, and I mean truly resounding, consensus at the Wingspread conference about the need for more resources. And I mean, you know, people jumping out of their seats kind of enthusiasm for this idea of more resources. Tougher question, of course, is how to obtain these resources. And I'll tell you, we had some people who were envisioning judicial strikes and judges picketing the courts, and you can imagine. And other people, of course, urging a little bit more polite pressure. But a lot of concern about this issue, and something that I'm sure you all share.
The presence of all the professional groups represented at the conference was vital to its success. Domestic violence advocates have increased awareness of domestic violence and changed the legal landscape for victims. And they continue to assist and speak out on behalf of the women that they serve. Family court judges and administrators struggle to ascertain the best interests of children exposed to domestic violence in the face of those increased caseloads and diminishing resources. Mental health, dispute resolution, and other professionals working in the family court system are a valuable but scarce resource for families experiencing domestic violence and for decision makers. Finally, researchers and scholars identify and provide cutting-edge research to promote the development of best practices. The expression of all these diverse and divergent paths and points of view heightens the level of discourse about domestic violence and ultimately leads to more thoughtful and more effective outcomes. So what is critical now, as Nancy is about to tell you, is that all these constituencies, and that is to say all of you, stay engaged with this process and this project as we carry it forward.
As you might imagine, participating at Wingspread was really energizing, and I think all of us who were there left a little exhausted, but highly energized. There was lots of discussion about fresh perspectives, about new research, about innovative ideas. And of course, this in itself led to a new dilemma. And that had to do with the fact that many people were ready to rush ahead with immediate implementation. And of course, all of us facing and working with families want to immediately bring to them the best we have to offer. At the same time, others were concerned about proceeding with a little more cautious reflection. Everybody did finally agree that we do need to develop some best practices, and we do need to be thoughtful about how we develop those, but we don't have any time to lose in the process. So what next? Some working groups are being developed. One aimed at creating some common vocabulary. We discovered that many of us may have been thinking similar things, but calling things something else. And I've found in conversations with people that we all use the language a little bit differently. We need to come up with some common terminology. Investigation of this idea of patterns of domestic violence and how those might imply some different interventions and outcomes for families. Development of culturally appropriate screening protocols, as well as best practices around assuring good and safe outcomes for children. Some even more tangible results since the conference have to do with the upcoming publication of a special domestic violence issue of the Family Court Review. It is available online already, so you don't need to wait for it to come in the mail. It features articles by authors with a variety of backgrounds and professional experiences, and I want to publicly thank those authors for their contributions. Many of them are here, and I also especially want to recognize my co-editor, Kelly Brow Olson, who put in many hours on helping this come to fruition. As I said, these articles are available online, and I encourage you to go back to your rooms tonight and read them, and as well as to talk to all of the many authors that are here, and you can actually engage in some discussion with them. There are also some very thought-provoking essays, which ask some tough and interesting questions that need more consideration and discussion from all of us. This is an exciting and hopeful time for those of us who work in the field of domestic violence, and I sincerely hope that the Wingspread Conference and the report will serve as a catalyst for future professional collaboration. The goal is not to rush to a hasty consensus. These are tough questions that need a lot of deliberation, but this is a call for an honest and direct communication effort. And as Claire said, we invite you, I would say challenge you and implore you to engage with us in these conversations. And I think there's no better time to start than at this very conference. So I would encourage you to have some conversations here with people you don't normally talk to or you might not even know, to do some listening to their perspectives and their experiences in working with issues of domestic violence. And when you get home, please seek out some opportunities for dialogue in your community. There's a lot to talk about and a lot to learn. And to that end, I want to leave you with a few tips from the master collaborators, Billy Lee Dunford Jackson and Peter Salem, who in their article that's featured in the Family Court Review give these tips for professional collaboration. First, they say, take your time. If this was easy, we would have done it a long time ago. Have lunch. In other words, get to know each other a little bit. Look in the mirror. Reflect on your experiences, your biases, your triggers. Communicate better and more often. Listen carefully and learn. Cross-train one another. Develop joint projects, and they caution, start small. Structure processes inclusively. Focus on potential, but don't ignore the risks. Thank you.
Thank you very much, Nancy and Claire. I cannot be struck with that overview as to how complex the issue of domestic violence is. It can be a little daunting. Our next speaker is Joan Kelly. Dr. Kelly needs no introduction, and anything that I say in this introduction will not do justice to her credentials. Joan B. Kelly, Ph.D., a clinical psychologist, researcher, teacher, consultant. She's amazing. She received her Ph.D. from Yale University. For 38 years, her research practice and teaching has focused on research in children's adjustment and divorce, custody and access issues, divorce mediation, and application of child development research to custody and access decision making. She has more than 80 publications, including the book Surviving the Breakup, How Children and Parents Cope with Divorce. Joan was a member of the recent AFCC Task Force on Parenting Coordination, which developed standards of practice. Dr. Kelly has been honored in many ways with many awards, including the Fellow of the American Psychological Association, the Distinguished Mediator Award from the Academy of Family Mediators, and from AFCC, she earned the Distinguished Research Award, the Stanley Cohen Award, and the Meyer Elkin Award. Joan is past president of the Board of Directors of the Academy of Family Mediators and the California Dispute Resolution Institute. I turn it over to Joan Kelly, PhD.
Thank you, Emil, for that gracious introduction. And I would like to, can you hear me in the back? Well, maybe we should use both. Can I use both?
That may be good, John.
Can you hear me now? No.
Do you want to use this one?
Can I use both at once?
You may get feedback.
I'm wasting precious moments. Okay, can you hear me now?
Yes.
Yay. All right. I would like to compliment Claire and Nancy on what I think as I thought was a very balanced and elegant presentation about Wingspread. I must tell you that while we were there, it felt neither elegant or balanced. It was an interesting experience for all of us, and it at times took courage to speak to what we were all thinking, and it was a remarkable outcome, and I was happy to participate in that. My presentation tonight, as was indicated, focuses on the most current research on differentiation among types of domestic violence, and I point only in a minute to some of the implications of this, part of which Nancy and Claire touched on. More recent research of the last 10 to 15 years has led us to a broader understanding of domestic violence or intimate partner violence. And we now understand that battering, of course, is one very serious form of domestic violence, but it is not the only form of domestic violence, nor is it the most common form of violence among intimate partners. So that is tonight what I want to very briefly speak to, and the article that was mentioned that is in Family Court Review will provide more in-depth information. I think that Nancy and Claire probably spoke adequately to the issue of why it's important to differentiate. Because of the one-size-fits-all paradigm, many of us have heard from judges and lawyers, mental health professionals, custody evaluators, and mediators that the view that all domestic violence was battering did not really fit with their experience in their various professional functions. Certainly, differentiation, as we move in this direction, it not only amplifies our understanding of this very complex social problem, but also helps us think through in a more useful way how we can help different families more appropriately. Also, of course, differentiation can and must lead to more effective screening instruments, and it's certainly our hope that in moving the direction of differentiation, that we will rethink training programs for domestic violence, because the one-size-fits-all training typically that focuses exclusively on battering and the power and control wheel has some serious limitations for some other types of domestic violence and those who participate in that. Certainly, there were many concerns and are concerns expressed about differentiation, and very briefly, one of the major concerns is that if we differentiate domestic violence, that this will lead to rigid adherence to typologies, And that, of course, as was stated, there's limited information available to make differentiation at this point. It is important to understand, as we talk about differences among types of domestic violence, that there are no pure forms. There are no pure categories. And so when we move in the direction of differentiation among types of domestic violence, we constantly have to be aware of that. People and their circumstances are inherently messy. And we probably get more than our share of messy circumstances in the family court work that's done. So it's going to be important not to talk of typologies, for example, as if they are very discrete categories where there's no overlap between categories. I'd like to take a look at briefly at the history of domestic violence to say how have we gotten to where we are. Domestic violence historically has been studied in a number of different samples. The first research was done primarily in small shelter samples of women who had been, many of them, who experienced battering, and a lot of our early data. Oh, thank you. I forget that I don't have my computer here.
Do you want to do it?
Yeah, I'll do it. Sorry. There we go. Okay. So a lot of our early data was derived from reports of women who came to shelters, hospital samples, and so on. But then concurrently, we saw research begin to emerge in nationally representative samples and large community samples, of course, clinical research as well, and from batterer treatment groups. And what is really we've come to understand is that the data from these different samples, these different populations of primarily women, but also men and women, has in fact yielded different data, and that it is this different data from these different samples that has caused confusion and dissent amongst practitioners and between practitioners and researchers. And this has really resulted in quite a bit of acrimony. So, for example, if you just look at shelter, if you just look at shelter samples versus nationally representative samples, they yield quite different data with respect to the incidence of violence. Women who came in, typically women who came into shelters, were more likely to have experienced more frequent episodes of severe violence compared to women reporting in nationally representative samples. There's also the issue of the time frame. If you ask people, have you experienced violence in the last 6 months or the last year, or the last 5 years. Each of these time frames, of course, yields different data in terms of the incidence of violence. Severity, we also find differences in these samples in terms of the severity and as measured by injuries and so on. Consequences of the violence differ, and there are gender differences here. Basically, at this point in time, there is, of course, a great deal of gender controversy at this point, where there are primarily two points of view. That is, the view that we have held for quite some time, that men are the primary perpetrators of violence in intimate partner relationships. And the other view, which is a newer view, but a robust view at this point, that there is absolute gender symmetry in partner violence. And in part, these different viewpoints can be reconciled by looking at the samples that have been studied and the measures that are being used in these different populations. Because we do see gender symmetry in some kinds of violence, and we see gender asymmetry in others with, for example, more injuries and of greater severity for women. As was indicated, terminology is something that we should be thinking about. For some time, in many states, the word domestic violence was meant to imply battering, or vice versa. Battering was domestic violence. And they were used interchangeably. And Michael Johnson, for example, has used the word intimate terrorism rather than battering because he wanted to capture the psychologically terrifying aspects of more classic battering He and I have chosen to use the words coercive controlling violence in the article that's appearing right now in Family Court Review and that I'll talk about tonight. But there's situational violence. It's been called also conflict-instigated violence. Female violence has been primarily described as violent resistance, and then separation engendered or separation instigated violence. So we need to pay attention to our terminology. I think it'll help us, if we do that and then define our terms, it'll help us speak more productively to each other about this. I think that regardless of all of our perspectives, we all agree that there are multiple dimensions of domestic violence to which we need to pay attention, that they include both psychological, physical, sexual, as well as financial aspects, and that none of those should be left out of any kind of consideration and or screening for violence. So tonight I want to talk about these four types of intimate partner violence. The first of them, situational couple violence. And the second, coercive controlling violence, violent resistance, and separation instigated violence. Each of these forms of violence have different characteristics and the potential for different outcomes after separation and divorce. And the research helps us understand intent, motivation, cause, extent of injuries, and whether control and coercion are central dynamics. And again, I'll remind you, there are no clean, absolute categories. There's always overlap. It's mushy, you know, but nevertheless, there are clearly patterns that have been identified. Situational couple violence. I want to start here because situational couple violence is the most common form of violence between intimate partners in the general population, some of whom, by the way, happen to be separating and in front of us. These data primarily are about situational couple violence are generally from large studies, national studies, and smaller community studies, and even a few studies of men in batterer treatment groups. Situational couple violence. I think the most important thing about this is that this violence is not embedded in a general pattern of power and control and coercion. It is not typically characterized by a chronic pattern of emotional abuse of the partner, including such things as isolation and harassment and stalking. Whereas men who batter women have men who batter women have significantly more misogynistic attitudes, for example, toward women, compared to either men who are engaged in situational couple violence or nonviolent men. Now, as you can see here, the incidence rate in both Canada and in the United States ranges somewhere around 9 to 12, 13% of the general population as measured on a 1 year incidence period. And Johnson reported that 89% of violence in a survey sample, as reported by women, was situational couple violence and was roughly gender symmetric, whereas 11% was coercive controlling violence. And the numbers were practically reversed in court and shelter samples, which I will return to in a minute. What do we know about situational couple violence? First of all, this is basically violence that arises out of disagreements and conflicts between partners. Out of these conflicts, there's an escalation into often mutual verbal provocation and insults, which then may escalate into physical struggles. These are men and women who do not manage their conflicts well. These episodes of violence are typically more minor forms of violence, if one can use that term, but it's important to differentiate between more minor and moderate and severe forms of violence. And more often you see with situational couple violence, pushing, shoving, grabbing. It seems like there's either sort of unwritten rules here. Injuries are not that common, although there are exceptions I'll talk about. They're generally contained. And I think of importance to us is that in situational couple violence, generally we do not find the partners fearful,
of each other. These people have really poor problem-solving strategies. And I would have to say, as a clinician, they don't have very good impulse control. They get into arguments, and it escalates out of control. Now, some studies have found that there really is no sex difference in terms of fearfulness of the partner, that men and women are capable of stating their needs. My own experience with some of these couples is that they are very feisty and quite difficult actually to manage, for example, in a mediation, but quite capable of speaking to what they believe their entitlements are. The other thing about situational couple violence is that there's no particular pattern. It could be that it happened once 20 years ago. It could be that it is episodic, that it happened 3 weeks ago. There just simply isn't a particular pattern. But we do know about situational couple violence that it decreases with age and over time. It's also more likely than coercive controlling violence to stop after separation. In a Canadian study, they found approximately two-thirds of the men and 60% of the women said that the violence that they'd had between them stopped after separation. Now, in this particular study, there wasn't a distinction made between coercive controlling violence and situational couple violence, although it being a large national survey study, we were more likely to see situational couple violence in this particular population. About half of the violence that is considered situational couple violence is mutual. That is that both parties mutually engage in this, perpetrated by both men and women. And as you can see here, amongst those with situational couple violence, some of the time women are the initiators of the violence and the only member of the couple who are violent, and on the other hand, in situational couples, a certain percentage, as you can see here, of both men and women report that only the male was violent. One of the things that's really important in research is to be able to talk to both of the parties. And so much of the early research, they spoke only to women. And so we learn more, whether it's a large-scale study or small-scale study, having both of the partners in the research. Here is data that is actually from Canada, and as you can see here, there's not much difference as reported by men and women about incidents of severe husband-to-wife violence, again within the category of situational couple violence. Note, however, that severe wife-to-husband violence is actually about double the rate. And as reported by both the women as well as the men in this study. Now, it's actually this data that has led many of the advocates for, I don't know how to say this in a politically correct way, but the men who are currently advocating that all violence is gender symmetric, that both men and women are equally participating in it, point to this data frequently to say, look, women are actually more violent than men, and this is a myth that it's mostly men perpetrating violence. But one has to take a very close look at the methodology of these studies. Although this study was well done and the data is good data, but certainly we have situations in our societies in which there is data suggesting that in some circumstances women are even more violent than the men. Now, a few things about emotional issues. Men and women who engage in situational couple violence as part of the conflict that escalates do yell at each other. They do call each other names. They may insult each other. But it's not accompanied by a history of coercive behaviors. And there may be jealousy, as there often is in relationships with a lot of conflict and so on. And it may be a current theme for some of these partners, but again, it's not accompanied by the stalking and the harassment, and probably not the risk, although we certainly need much more research in this area. When the risk is higher, the research that we have so far suggests that where This is research that's been done on samples of antisocial delinquent teenagers and young adults. So it's a special sample who have been identified and been in court systems and or criminal actions. So the delinquent, they're aggressive. In this group, they also participate in situational couple violence, but there's higher frequency and injuries are more common. And in this group, particularly if they have violence, for example, once or more a week, we will see fear of the partner, but we see it in both the men and the women because they are really putting each other at risk. And I certainly, in talking with judges both in the United States and Canada, they tell me that they are seeing much more severe violence perpetrated by teenage females as well as teenage males, and, of course, a lot of gang violence that's being reported certainly in our country, but I think elsewhere as well. One of the things probably we need to be concerned about is that the rate of violence is really astonishingly high among dating couples, late teens, early adults. Most of this research has been done amongst college students, but we see here females perpetrating violence at higher rates than the males. Injuries, as you can see here, occur in these groups, and these are mostly community samples, but nevertheless, I think we have some major issues because a lot of this violence is starting at age 15, 16, and 17, for example, and certainly will appear in family courts at some point. Turning now quickly to coercive controlling violence. From the data that we have now, classic battering or coercive controlling violence is primarily male perpetrated. There are certainly those amongst some of the representatives and the advocates for men who dispute this figure and say even in battering, it's more gender symmetric. One answer to that from a social scientist would be you have to look at the methodology of these studies and the way in which it was measured, and I think we will simply need more research to understand this in a more accurate way. But certainly, at this point, somewhere around 90% of more classic battering, coercive controlling violence, is perpetrated by men. It is also noteworthy, however, that we do see coercive controlling violence or battering in lesbian relationships, and also we do see battering in large representative samples, but it is significantly lower, as I indicated before, than the amount of situational couple violence. Here, as we've all learned from all of our training for, two decades now or more, we are talking about the dynamics of coercion and control and intimidation and extensive emotional abuse. Injuries, as we know, in this group are more severe compared to injuries in situational couple violence. And all of the characteristics that we talk about, denial, minimization, blaming the other, and so on, are true for this. And the risk of injury is much greater to victims of coercive controlling violence after separation. And that certainly is true, we know, from some clinical studies and experience, may also be true for men who are victims of female coercive controlling violence after separation. There's pretty good research to suggest that where there are severe personality disorders, that the violence is likely to be not only severe and chronic, pervasive. In shelter and or court and court samples, this is a secondary analysis that Michael Johnson did. He found that 68% of the women who came to court had and filed for protection orders had experienced coercive controlling violence, and of those women contacting shelters, 79% had experienced coercive controlling violence with very high rates of injuries, many of them severe. He also points out, and we need to remember, that even in court samples and even in shelter samples, there are still substantial numbers of men and women who were involved in situational couple violence rather than coercive controlling violence. I think all of us are familiar with the emotional abuse and control that is characteristic of coercive controlling violence, so I will not spend time on that, as well as behavioral observations that are characteristic of victims of a course of controlling violence. I want you to be aware of the fact that researchers actually have also... No, that's the wrong slide. Yeah. That researchers have been interested in battering, because even within the classification of course of controlling violence or battering, a number of social scientists have said, you know, and have hypothesized and then done research to say that within the category of male batterers, because all this research was on men, there are in fact differences, that all battering is not the same either, that all coercive controlling violence is not the same. And I'm not going to spend time on this because I don't have it, but it's interesting to look at this research. By the way, you have in your materials, in the conference book, a fairly extensive bibliography that supports and identifies a lot of the references that are on here, and that talks in that gives you the opportunity to look at articles that look in more depth at these, for example, these three types of battering, and we describe it more in the article. What's interesting to me, of course, is that the family-only male batterers, in many respects, do not differ on a variety of measures from nonviolent men, which presents, of course, for us some real dilemmas in court. But they talk about and the violence of the family-only men is generally confined just to the family, to the intimate relationship, and low to moderate levels of violence. The borderline dysphoric category involves more moderate to severe levels of violence. It's reactive partner violence. It most likely and most often occurs in response to situations eliciting jealousy and threats of abandonment, where someone reacts violently to separation. The generally violent antisocial male batterer is engaged in moderate to severe, the most severe forms of violence, and has the most violence outside of the family. And these men are really the most like the classic batterer. They use violence instrumentally to achieve their goals. And there are other, and they are also most likely to be the repeat assaulters, despite whatever treatment interventions are made. You tell me how much I have time. All right. Coercive controlling violence women. We don't have a lot of good systematic research with good methodologies. We do know that when women are batterers or coercive controlling violent women, that they actually look similar in terms of their use of the tactics that are defined for all of us on the power and control wheel. That there are a lot of similarities, except that male privilege is not the issue, but it's a use of a system. And the violence can range from mild to severe. Violent women who have nonviolent partners in Canada, using a 5-year time frame, you can see here about a fifth of the cases, the men were nonviolent, reporting violence by their female partners and supporting that, 28% of the women acknowledging their own violence with men. And here is also some evidence that women as well as men engage in more severe types of violence. You're giving me two minutes. Okay. I'll pass through the next slide and just point out that women, when they are violent, male victims report violence only 1/10 as often as women do. And of great interest is the fact that police are less likely to arrest women or file reports even for similar injuries. And so if there's a level of violence that's the same, the male is significantly more likely to be arrested and have a police report. Part of it has to do with, in our society, we've had a kind of, ha ha ha, the little woman is violence, and not really taking violence seriously on the part of women. But we certainly are in this group. Violent resistance, again, women's response to men who were coercively controlling violent for the most part. And notice how many women, 71%, who report responding to coercive controlling violence with violence of their own, which, by the way, also results in more severe injuries for women. And lesbians are more likely to use more severe violence than do heterosexual women in relationships. Read the article. There's some interesting things there about female resistance. Finally, separation instigated violence. As indicated, this is violence where there's no history of violence in the relationship at all prior to the separation or the period right around the separation. And the partner does not report a history of coercive or controlling violence. It occurs with both men and women. And can be triggered by a very traumatic separation or the humiliation of being abandoned or rejected. It's generally limited to one or two episodes. An important point is that the psychological responses of men and women who have perpetrated separation instigated violence differs from men and probably women who are engaged in coercive controlling violence. They are much more likely to acknowledge their violence. They're often really surprised that they were violent. They're more likely to comply with protection orders. Here is a list of risk factors as culled from the social science literature. One of the things to be paying attention to is that where there are households with children, there's actually a greater risk of violence between partners. Alcohol and drug abuse are significantly associated with domestic violence. And if we're working and identifying domestic violence, we should always also be looking for evidence of substance abuse. Finally, this research has some fairly important implications for our treatment programs for men and women where there's been violence. That is, we need a more differentiated response to in the treatment programs. Obviously, screening, as mentioned. Mediation. If you think about custody mediation, men and women in situational couple violence may be quite capable of mediating as opposed to where there's been coercive controlling violence. And, of course, with respect to parenting plans, there may be implications that we're going to hear about tomorrow morning. And with that, I'd like to thank you for your attention. Okay.